Have you ever played the game rock, paper, scissors? If you knew whether someone's going to do a rock, paper, or scissors, and if you had knowledge that what they were going to do every single time, how many times would you win? Every single time. You can figure this out. Paper over rock, scissors over paper, rock over scissors. We're going to look at David and Goliath, and we're going to find out that David was playing rock. With a story that's so well known, like David and Goliath, it's hard for us to hear it again. It's hard for us to hear something new. We've probably walked in this groove of the story for so long and for so many times that we already know the pastor's going to tell me I need to trust God more. Fair enough. As we enter into this series right now, I want to pay attention to the series that we just finished on Genesis. And in Genesis, we were talking about desire. I think I could have broadened that theme out and pulled it out a little bit more strongly for you. But the idea was that our desire is twisted. Our desire has been twisted away from God's good life, what he wants us to desire, and instead, we want to desire our own good life, a life that we form in our own image. And what we learned from the text was God's going to send out grace ahead of our sin, ahead of our twisted desires. He's going to send out grace to clothe us, to help care for us in this sinful world that we are creating by our own making. And our desire needs to be centered on Jesus, needs to be centered on who he is and his kingdom. We want to desire his kingdom. Through this series, I want to take that a little bit further, and I want to pay attention to our imagination. So often when we look at stories that maybe we learned in Sunday school, or maybe we know because everybody knows the story of David and Goliath, our imagination doesn't get sparked. We don't see something new, we only see what we already know. So I want to pay attention to imagining, what does the king look like, the true king, Jesus Christ, and what does his kingdom look like? And so we're going to talk about that as we go through this series, and we're doing it in light of also the fact that we're revamping, re-looking at our children's ministry. What do we do with our kids on Sunday morning, and how are they taught? Two of the guiding things that we're looking at for our kids is wonder and imagination. My own study and my own experience has been that we're afraid of questions in the church, but also in other institutions. I want our children to know that they can ask us questions and we're not afraid of them. I want our kids to have the wonder that all children have, and I want them to hold that wonder, and I want them to be able to express that wonder. And I want our kids to have imagination, because our God is so much bigger than what the adults can tell them God is like. I want our kids to have sparks of imagination so that as we teach our children about worship, they also are teaching us, what does it mean to worship an almighty, all-powerful God? So come with me as we visit some stories. Over the series, we're going to visit stories that you know very well, and we're going to pay attention. How were they interpreted before, and what might God be telling us? This is new. You need to pay attention to something a little bit different here. The story about David and Goliath. This so often gets reduced down to, well, be like David. David was courageous. He didn't trust in armor. He put that aside. And instead, he trusted in God. You also should trust God. Well and good. It doesn't always work that way for us, and it doesn't always work that way for David. Shortly after this, David ends up in the wilderness. I could imagine David saying, hey, God, I thought you were on my team here. What am I doing out here? 10 years. He wanders in the wilderness. He was anointed king, but he doesn't get to be king. And David's son Absalom rises up against David, forms a revolt. David has to run away. I imagine David was saying to himself, you know, I heard this story about a guy who was able to kill giants. Maybe what I should just do is trust God more, and I can beat Absalom. The idea of just trust God more, or just be more courageous, the moral of the story, doesn't give us what we need in that situation. You can't just trust God, be courageous, and everything works out for you. What if we started to ask questions ourselves? Why did David take 5 stones? You know, if he really trusted God, he should have just taken 1, right? He's not going to miss. Or if he really trusted God, he wouldn't even need stones. We start to ask questions, and the questions can get us in trouble, can't they? You know, God, in my life, I've run out of stones. Why haven't my stones struck the giant? What if we started asking questions of God that way? What if we started asking questions of the story? And I think we shy away from these questions because it's terrifying to ask them, because the answers don't always work out the way we would like. It's terrifying to ask those questions together because we're not quite sure what God is doing. And we're sure that the answers might not be exactly what we would like. The text isn't meant as a recipe for how to kill a giant. You're not supposed to read this text, great, now if I go find a giant, I know how to kill it. It's not meant that way. The text isn't about David and Goliath. It's about David and Saul. And if you pay attention to the context of the story, you recognize this isn't about David and a giant. It's about David and the king who's currently king. And so we have to look, what's happening in the story? Why is this context being built up this way so that this story fits within that larger narrative? Who's Saul? Well, Saul's the king who was rejected by God. If we pay attention to the chapters just before, Saul was rejected because Saul liked to use God to help Saul's work. And he was going to use worship, he was going to use God language to kind of get the people on his side. Maybe it's a protection, maybe it's a rune so that I don't get hurt. I'm going to use God's worship that way. But he wasn't doing God's work anymore, he was doing Saul's work and asking God to help him. David's first work as an anointed king is in secret to serve a bad king. And the question the text might be asking of us is, so does Saul know David was anointed? That happened in secret. Does Saul know? Is he going to find out? That's part of the drama. That's part of the questions we're asking here. So who are the Philistines? Well, the Philistines are Israel's enemy. They're the dominant force that's kind of been harassing Israel for a little while. If we look back to chapter 13, it says that there was no smith in the land. I'm a smith. I realize that just as you were saying it, sometimes you realize something just as you... There was no smith in the land because England hadn't happened yet. There was no smith in the land. The Israelites had no blacksmith. They weren't able to make swords because the Philistines said that would be awful if these guys had swords. So anytime there was a blacksmith, I presume the Philistines would come in and destroy it. They didn't want the Israelites to have weapons. So the Philistines are the dominant force. They have greater technology, and they're kind of persecuting the Israelites, and they want to keep the status quo. They want to keep things going this way. Now, they're trying to dominate and attack Israel in a land that is very familiar to us because it's on the news all the time. War is very costly. And to try to dominate a nation in that area of Israel, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, it's hard to win a war there. Incredibly costly. There's all kinds of caves, and a couple of chapters before, it talks about the Israelites hiding out in the caves. That's happening right now, Syria, and people are hiding in caves. The Philistines were the dominant culture, as I said, the dominant power. And the Israelites had got a king. Well, that could be real trouble, because they might unite. Right now, they're just kind of a squabbling band of tribes, but if they were united into one kingdom, they're going to provide a threat to us on this side, says the Philistines, whereas on this side, we've got other nations. It's just more trouble for us. We'd like to dominate Israel so that we can win the wars on the other side. And how do you win a war that's super costly in a land that's really hard to trap people and get them to submit or die? You intimidate them. Intimidation is a great way of saying, we are really violent and we will win, but you don't have to pay the cost of that violence, right? With intimidation, you can gain effective submission without having to pay the cost of violence, and it makes your violence much more effective. So Goliath and the Philistines were involved in intimidation. Let's give the Israelites more reasons and better reasons not to fight. Let's get this one-on-one duel to happen. They have a big, tall king. Maybe they can send out their king, we can defeat him, and let's give up this king business. That's the Philistines' plan. Up to the battle comes a shepherd boy. He's probably about 14, he's maybe 15, a young man. He starts asking questions. Trouble. And the story in this moment takes on three characters: Eliab, David's eldest brother, Saul, and David. Both Eliab and Saul they looked like kings. So when Samuel meets Saul, way back in early parts of Samuel, he sees Saul and he says, "Surely this is the Lord's anointed. He looks like a king. He stands head and shoulders above everybody else." And the chapters before remind us again and again, Saul looks like a king and he stands really tall and really big. Same thing with Eliab. When Samuel goes, because the Lord has told him that he's going to anoint a new king, and he goes to Jesse's family, and he sees Eliab, he's like, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before me. This guy looks like a king." And God says, "No, that's not the guy, the other guy." So Eliab and Saul both look like kings. They're big, tall warriors. So it's fitting then that Eliab says to David, "What are you doing here? What are you doing asking these questions? You're stirring up trouble." He gets mad because David is asking questions. And I think we all get this. I think we all understand that asking questions can be very threatening. When you ask questions, particularly in a camp, an army, that isn't really doing what they probably should be doing, fighting, you know, army stuff. If you come in and you start asking questions, "How come you guys aren't doing the thing you're supposed to be doing?" It's a threatening question. Eliab gets this and he gets mad. He gets mad at David for shaming the people. Maybe Eliab here is supposed to, I mean, he's the first brother of seven. He's a lot older than David. And if your little brother comes and shames the whole army in front of you, what is the army expecting that you're supposed to do? You're supposed to beat up your brother. Okay? Put him in his place, knock him around, and send him back to dad. The fact that Eliab doesn't do that, perhaps David's a little bit more physical looking than maybe we give him credit for. So Eliab gets mad because David is asking questions, and his questions shame the army. Saul hears about these questions. I mean, you can imagine a runner comes up to Saul and says, "Hey, Saul, there's a shepherd boy who's been asking questions." And Saul, of course, says, "Great, bring me the what? This part of the story always seems weird to me. Why does Saul say, "Great, bring me that shepherd boy. I'd love to see that shepherd boy so that I can put upon this shepherd boy the entire fate of the nation." Right? It's weird. And then Saul says, "You know, you can't do that. You're too small." But the shepherd boy says, "I sure can. I'm totally awesome." "Oh, okay," says Saul. "Great, go ahead and do it." Something's weird here with Saul, and I really only have four options. Either Saul trusts God. We have no evidence from the text that Saul trusts God, that Saul sees that David is God's anointed. There's no evidence from the text. Therefore, we don't believe that Saul is here trusting God, and that's why he chose David. Second option, Saul is incredibly clever, and he can tell what David is and what David's going to do. But when David talks to Saul, he says that he struck down the lion and the bear. He doesn't say how. It sounds like unarmed combat. It sounds like he did this with his bare hands. And the text isn't giving us any sense here that Saul is a great military mastermind. I'm not sure that the text is trying to say to us that Saul is really clever and saw what was going to happen. The third option, probably the most likely one here that the author is trying to show us, is that Saul is a fool. Saul just kind of doesn't really understand what's going on. "Oh, good, somebody wants to go fight. Here's your armor. Off you go. Oh, it doesn't quite fit. That's okay. Put the armor down. Away you go. Have a good time." I'm not sure I believe that one, though. I think it's probably the most likely what the author is telling us, but I think there's a fourth option that's kind of fun to think about. Saul's devious. Goliath says, "You servants of Saul, send one out to fight me, and if you win, we'll be your servants. If you lose, you'll be our servants." But he's not really addressing Saul. He's not really talking to Saul. He's not really saying Saul's going to be a servant of ours. And if you were in the army of Israel, and you heard that your king is talking to a 15-year-old boy, and that 15-year-old boy is going to go out, and if he loses, you're going to be a slave, are you like, "Yes, good job, king"? I'm on your team. No, you're starting to wonder, what's wrong with the king? What's he doing? And Saul sends the boy out, he's trying to send the boy out in his armor. If this little boy loses, the armor's going to be Goliath's. Is Saul kind of throwing the game? I don't think Saul has the imagination here. We've heard about questions. Now we're going to hear about imagination, and then we're going to turn to fit. I don't think Saul has the imagination about what God is doing, about how God is working in this world, about how God is working in that story in that very moment. Saul's imagination has become so clouded by the Philistines are better, we are worse. But bad kings do not sacrifice themselves for their people. They sacrifice their people for themselves. So Saul says, David, go ahead, take my armor. Have a good time. But David says that armor doesn't quite fit. Is this about David saying, no, I'm not going to trust armor, I'm going to trust God? I'm not so sure that's what we're trying to be told here, is that David's more about trusting God than he is about trusting armor. I think it's more about fit. David puts on the armor, and it doesn't fit. Up to this point, we've been told, the last few chapters, Saul sucks as a king. Okay, David, you've been anointed as king. Are you going to wear his armor? Are you going to be a king like David? Are you going to go into battle like Saul goes into battle? Are you going to use the people, serve the people, sort of? Are you going to try to please the people, but only to your ends? Are you going to be a king like Saul? Or are you going to be a king like David? The armor doesn't fit. So David takes off the armor, and he goes into the battle as David, the way David has been gifted and skilled. Now, kings like Saul don't like David's. Saul does not want a super successful, a super imaginative lieutenant. Saul wants mediocre lieutenants, guys who can do the job, but essentially guys who want to please Saul. Compare that to David. You've heard maybe the stories of David and his mighty men. When the roll call happens and you hear the list of men and their great achievements that they have done, they're greater than David's achievements. And the mighty men of David, they come from, there's Uriah the Hittite, and the list of them are all from not Israel. David goes out and he says, you're amazing, come on my team, I want to make you even better, I want you to do amazing things. Whereas Saul's like, you're amazing, come on my team, but make sure I look better than you. Make sure I am better than you. Saul doesn't want men of imagination. He doesn't want mighty men of creative, innovative solutions. Have you ever seen Alexander Ovechkin play hockey? Better yet, have you seen him play at an All-Star game? In the shootout, Alexander Ovechkin comes alive in ways that, in the actual game, he's really combative and he has a competitiveness about him. But in the All-Star game, it's just pure joy. Watch his face in the All-Star game. Watch his face when he sits on the sidelines watching the other players take the shots. He loves this game. And he's talking to them like, hey, how did you do that? What were you doing there? What's your plan against this? How are you going to do it? He's just super imaginative, but he's also curious about what the other guys are doing. He takes great joy in everybody else's imagination. Not so Saul. If Saul was curious, if Saul cared about imagination, he'd say, you're putting the armor down. What's your plan? You seem really confident. All your words say, you've got this. What are you going to do? Is this like some cool move, like the small guy against the big guy, you know how to dodge really good, and then you've got some twirling cool thing? Can you just show me? I want to see it. Can you teach me? I'd love to learn. No, he's like, great, go, have a good time. If he was curious and imaginative, he would have asked. David, are you going to be a king like Saul, or are you going to be a king like David? Choosing not to be a king like Saul is going to be costly. 10 years in the wilderness. David accepts what it means to be a king like David, even though it's going to be costly. So let's take a look at what he does. The text tells us that he takes his staff, his sling, and he goes down to the river to get some stones. Now the sling is going to be a small pouch. Sometimes it's out of leather, but it could be just two cords with a space between them. And the two cords come up, it hangs down, maybe about that long. And you put the stone in the end of the sling, and you start to swing it. There's a couple of different cool motions you can do. If you want to sling fast, you can just kind of over your head and down, or you can spin it around a bunch of times and let it go. And you let go of one end of the cord, and the rock goes flying out. That's the sling. But he also has a staff. Not quite sure. Maybe he was using a sling that way, but he could have been using a staff with a sling on the end of the staff, and you put the sling on the end of the staff, and you spin it around with the staff, and you whip it. The staff can throw a bigger rock. Kind of cool. Do you know how fast these things fly? Have you guys ever seen lacrosse at a high level? It's moving. One of our baseball players, I spoke too quickly there, our being my team, the Toronto Blue Jays, one of our baseball players got hit in the head by a fastball. He was wearing a helmet. He had concussion syndrome, and he's out for the rest of the season. We didn't have a great season, but let's not get into that. So he had to take a seat. He's not allowed to play anymore because he had a concussion from a baseball thrown just with an arm speed, pretty fast, can give you a concussion. So lacrosse, you've got a stick. That ball is moving. And now a stick with a sling, or even just a sling, it's coming out there as powerful as our most powerful handguns today. Same stopping power as the .45 Magnum. Who's the underdog here? I've played a few video games, and not tons. You guys laughed a little too quickly there. I've played some video games, and video games reduce war, infantry units, tank units, and artillery units. They kind of simplify it for us so that we can kind of enjoy the game without having to get super complex. Infantry, artillery, and tanks. They each have their own speciality. What are they? Rock, paper, and scissors. The tank is the rock. The tank is really good against the infantry, but it's not very good against the artillery. The artillery is really good against the tank. It can take it out before the tank's close enough, but the infantry, it's harder to hit off the little targets, so the infantry can kind of get around, get the artillery. And the infantry, they're really good against artillery, but they're just cannon fodder against the tank. Rock, paper, scissors. What's Goliath? Goliath is a tank. He's big. He's got tons of plus bonuses to attack, tons of bonuses to defense. But he can't move very much. He's a tank. What's he expecting? He's expecting Israel to send out a tank or an infantryman, one or the other. He's really good against infantry. That's fun for him. At best, they're going to send out a tank. Worse for him. But he knows their best tank. It's Saul. He kind of seems to know Saul's not really into this. He seems to know this is more about the servants of Saul than challenging Saul himself. He knows the worst case scenario for him is weapons, better armor. He's ready. What's David? David is artillery. David comes out with his artillery and has no difficulty. He's playing rock, paper, scissors, and he knows what the other guy has. Anybody here seen David throw a rock? Nobody knows. Nobody has seen him except himself, so he knows how good he is. And if he hung out with the sheep, and all he did was throw rocks, he's as good as a professional soldier at slinging rocks. And a few chapters before in Judges, we hear about these Benjamites, the slingers, who can hit a hare. And I don't mean a rabbit, I mean a hare off your head. They are accurate as all get out. David knows what he's got in his rock pack. He knows what he can do with it. I'm not sure Goliath knows. Yes, David dedicates the fight to God. Yes, David trusts God, and so should we, but he's not going out on a limb here. Malcolm Gladwell's and others have shared with us, and we have learned, that David's choice of weaponry here is brilliant. He's not so much the underdog. He's got some power here. David trusts that God has prepared him for just such a time as this. David trusts that God has skilled him And David trusts that his anointing will carry him through the battle. He trusts God. One of the sayings over Christianity that has become very popular in the last little while is that God is not looking for ability, he's looking for availability. God is not looking for ability, but availability. And I am troubled by that phrase. I'm troubled by it because it's half true. Yes, God needs us to be available to him. Yes, God is able to use people who aren't superstars. Yes, God is able to use all of us. And he is going to shame the world, and he's going to use the weak and the foolish to shame the wise. Yes, yes, and yes. But because we've heard that, we discount ability. And we start to say, God doesn't need your ability to make his kingdom come. And we start to say, God just needs you to sign up. It's true, but it's only part of the truth. Because God gives us unique skills and abilities that are who we are. And he calls us in a way that's congruent to us. If you're lining up for a flight, and you see me walk up beside you, and the person at the counter greets me and says, "Hey, Micah, glad you're here. Can you fly the plane today?" Don't get on the plane. I don't know what I'm doing. Now, I will certainly pray lots, but I don't know what I'm doing on flying the plane. Take the pilot's plane. Take the one that he's flying or she's flying, because she's been so well trained, she knows how to fly the plane. Continue to pray, trust in God that the plane will fly the way it's supposed to and that the pilot will stay awake and alert and do what they're supposed to. So yes, trust God, but also trust the skills and ability that God has gifted to that pilot. The saying that God doesn't need your ability, or he's not looking for your ability, he's just looking for your availability. That saying was invented to help people get off the sidelines, and I get it. None of us are qualified, are we? Hello, I'd like to do God's work. Really? Are you qualified? None of us are qualified. So the idea that God doesn't need our ability, but he needs our availability, gets to the idea that none of us are qualified to do his work. David was highly skilled at flinging rocks at super speed. Was he going to try to be king? Was he going to defeat giants the way Saul does? Or was David going to be the man that God had called him to be? Will you, will I, will we make our ability available to God? Is the real question. You have all been gifted and skilled by God. And we face situations in our workplace, in our family life, where God is asking us to be the people that he has formed us and shaped us to be. Will we step out, inspired by God, with imagination, asking questions so that we can learn more and see the truth of where God is leading us? And will we... For each of us in our church, family, or work life, we can be so tempted to try to be other people, to try to fight somebody else's battles, rather than paying attention to how God has called us. We need new imagination, and to do that, we need to welcome the questions that challenge the status quo. Another problem of this text is that we often read the text and think we're supposed to be like David. I'm David. I'm going to kill the giant, and people are going to cheer for me, and Saul's in my way. But we often miss a warning of the text not to be a king like Saul, not to be someone who squashes imagination or punishes the imaginative, creative people. Let's make sure that our church and our workplaces and our families are not places that are threatened by questions or that squash imagination, or that force people into callings that are not theirs. Jesus Christ calls himself, stands before us as king, and he's not afraid of our questions. You know the stories in the New Testament of the Pharisees. They come and they ask him questions, and they're not asking nice questions. They're trying to trap him. But he's not scared of their questions, and he's not scared of your questions, of our questions about God, why are things the way they are? And God loves imagination to us in parables so that our imagination gets us interested and invited into his story. And he speaks to us in metaphor, and he speaks to us through color and life so that we might indeed experience life abundantly, full of imagination and vibrancy. And God doesn't give us armor that doesn't fit. He says to us, "Come to you, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke. It's easy and it's light." And the word there for easy basically means it fits you. He says, "Come to me, I'll give you my yoke, and my yoke fits you. It's been made for you. It's not my armor that doesn't fit you, and I'm not trying to make you do things the way I would do them. Yes, we get made in Christ's image, but only because we dwell in him. That's how we get formed into his image." He says, "Take my yoke, and I'll be with you, and I will dwell in you." And that's how you grow up, move into our world, as we are sent from this place into the world on Monday morning. My hope is that all of us will be people who are open to questions, open to seeing questions asked, open to being part of finding the answers, and it would inspire and lead us to be a people of imagination. And in that imagination, looking to see, how am I called to be me in this space? How is God asking me to be present here? We certainly look at what other people have done. Who has gone before us? Where can we learn? But we take that and we say, I am here. I have been uniquely gifted for this place. God has asked me to be here. God loves the specific you that you are. And he's asking you to serve in your workplace, in your family, and in the church in a way that's so particular to who you are. And so my hope is that we would be people who foster imagination with each other, who foster good questions, and who help each other to see what does it mean to be called in a very specific and personal way to do the work of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Amen.